version. I brought in a couple of other versions to compare translations.
This is the classic Sansino edition, which was the only English translation we really had to depend on before this new Art Scroll translation came, outside of the verses and volumes that Steinsaltz did. This is Steinsaltz in Hebrew, which will help us through every now and then. Ben Sorer Ur More. A Ben Sorer Ur More is a stubborn and rebellious son. It makes it clear that it's talking about a Ben, right from the start, at the beginning of the Perek. It's a son. We'll see in a little bit that it's going to unfold and make sure that you know that. Not talking about daughters here. And the question that the Mishnah is going to ask is, how do we know when someone can fall into this category? Because a project of the Mishnah and a project of the Talmud is to understand categorically when people fall into certain categories and when they don't. What makes them ultimately be in that category, defining the words that ultimately the Torah uses to categorize them in such a way. And then to provide you some insight as to how you arrive to that place, what circumstances add to the fact that it could be a fulfillment of that category, what circumstances completely really negate that category entirely, in this case, sometimes others. So it says, "Me'ematai nasei ben sorer amore." When can a boy become a ben sorer amore? For now, just you see that in our translation, by the way, that these words are written in the italics. So what does it mean that these words are written in the italics, and they're not entirely defined when it comes to a translation project like this? Because remember, every translation, in the way we say it from learning from our teachers, every translation is an interpretation. So the reality is here is that the Ben Sorer Amore is a category that's put out, and it's a category that is not necessarily delineated here because they don't want to say exactly stubborn or rebellious like this translation does. Listen to this one, Sansino. Ben Sorer Amore, a stubborn and rebellious son. When does he become liable to the penalty of a stubborn and rebellious son? So what's the difference between the translations? First of all, this one, ours, said Ben Sorer Amore. A previous Mishnah mentioned the Ben Sorer Amore. Me'ematai nasei Ben Sorer Amore. When can a boy become a Ben Sorer Amore? So if you're reading as a student of the Gemara with this translation, you haven't gotten the words stubborn and rebellious. And you have to ask the question, why does the editor of this version and or the translators actually go that direction? Because there's a possibility that the standardized translations in such a case don't actually either A, play into the Gemara's understanding of what the actual cases are, and he wants to clue you in to such a fact. B, nobody really agrees on the translation enough to actually put it in after a lot of work in that vein. Or C, leaves you to ask a question. What does it mean, Ben Sorer More? We'll get to it. But it's obviously a question of developmental kind of growth in children, because the Mishnah immediately goes to a place where it's answering about this child's reality as this stage of life. Mish yavishtei sarot, from when he produces two pubic hairs after reaching the age of 13. Now, idiomatically again, and you'll see that this comes a theme in the way that I'm looking at the Schottenstein edition. From the fact that he's 13 years old is not actually written in the Hebrew of the Mishnah. So I want to leave that aside as having been an idiomatic place marker or an idiomatic insertion of the translator of this Schottenstein edition, and we don't necessarily need to, in essence, accept that right from the start. But it is from when he produces two pubic hairs because we have Shia Vishte Sarot. And how do we know that it's actually two hairs, as in hairs that are the ones that are not on one's beard or head? Because this measure of Shte Sarot, of two pubic hairs, is a measure that the rabbis use for talking about coming of age in both boys and girls, around the Gemara. So when does that really happen? Well, it's a matter of some discourse, according to the Gemara. Forget the fact that it's a discourse today, because early onset puberty has become somewhat of an issue in the news. So too was it a little bit of a discussion back for the sages in the Talmudic era. And you'll see that a little while down the line, when we get to some texts, the Tosafot, they're actually going to tell you that it was amazing certain boys and girls could sire children back when they were 7 and 8 years old, back in the day. And this is why some of the thinking about children has to happen in terms of their reaching majority and what they're responsible for when they just only have either two hairs or... What's the reality, though, of the two hairs? The two hairs here are a delimiting factor as to when this child reaches a certain stage, when you can call that child a ben sorer more. Is it that I can call the child with two hairs simply a ben? Or do I know that it's talking specifically about the category of ben sorer more? When I have a child who reaches the age with two hairs, usually it's understood, and that's why the translator actually put it in, that it reaches the age of 13, and he's become a child of majority age. What do I then call the child of majority age? I call him a ben anymore. I call him maybe a bar mitzvah, because that's a son of the commandments, but by saying bar mitzvah, I now am actually referring to him as a person of majority within the tradition, and therefore the term ben wouldn't make sense to me anymore. I would now call that child bar mitzvah or ish l'chol davar, an adult of majority age. So therefore, the reason why, too, I believe that the translators put this ben sorer morei phrase is because they don't want you to separate out, I call him ben when he reaches the stage of having two pubic hairs, because we know that the term ben, when somebody has two pubic hairs, is generally considered he's reached the age of 13, a majority, but I wouldn't call him ben anymore. Thusly, I have ben sorer morei. I have whatever this category is vis-a-vis ben sorer morei. So I've got to define that. There's a unique, obviously, time frame from when this child is ben sorer morei. And that time frame is from the time when he produces mei sheyavi shtei sarot, and that mem there is important, from the time that he produces these two pubic hairs, v'ad sheyakif zakan, and until he has a beard. Now, if I just said to you, ad sheyakif zakan, until he has a beard, what might you think? What beard are we talking about? Beard of one's face. Because a zakan, a beard, is generally understood to be a sign of puberty and maturity. But a full beard, does it really come in at age 13? You have what's considered to be this word fuzz, even in the halacha. So what beard, which zakan are we talking about? The Mishnah actually goes out of its way to explain to you, we're not talking about a facial beard. You're talking about the time that he has two pubic hairs. Until the time what? Avad sheyakif zakan, until the time his beard grows round. What does that mean? Oh, hatachton velo ha'elyon, the lower beard, not the upper beard. So in case we need a lesson on puberty, and when you get a full sense of pubic hair that surrounds both the male member and the reproductive organs, they, in essence, would say that there's a certain period of time that is between the first onset of the first two pubic hairs and the time that you have a full amount of pubic hair around the male organs. That's the time frame in which the Mishnah wants to define the possibility of becoming this category of ben sorer morei. the Mishnah goes out of its way again to tell you, you might have thought that I was talking about a zakan from the face, because I used the word zakan, except what? Ela, and this word Ela in Hebrew, which many times means rather, kind of in our modern parlance, but here kind of says, Ela, wait a minute, you might have thought still that I'm really talking about the zakan, the beard of the face, and someone might bring me an argument that no, really, because this is the way, right, Jewish conversation works in the Gemara, we're not talking about that beard, we're talking about the beard on the face. And we want to extend the time period thusly to have the category where he could still be Ben Sora Mori, even though I wouldn't use the term son, Ben, during the time at which he's reached the age of majority. No, it is the lower pubic hair, it's that zone we're talking about. And what should dibru chachamim b'lashon nikiyah? That the chachamim, the sages of blessed memory, used clean language. A way of speaking that doesn't get you all of the names of the organs and particulars about what's really happening down there. They simply used clean language. Do you have a comment, question?
So, if he didn't grow a full set of pubic hair, he would always be a minister.
So the rabbis have categories of people that, A, never fully develop in terms of their reproductive capacity, B, who never really even develop the actual organs themselves, and C, when someone lacks hair, they're going to make a decision as to whether or not age is the rule of majority. So thusly, we have the bar mitzvah concept, and no worries that that child who has normal reproductive development can still be considered of age.
When did the bar mitzvah concept of age come to be here, or is it a later development?
Well, we're going to see in our mission, actually, that the notion that one reaches a certain age and that you are then responsible for mitzvot comes in right here in our Mishnah, among other places. That's definitely a concept that is ancient. The notion of if we're talking about any bar mitzvah ceremony,
no.
That's a whole different story. But here you see, and we're going to see right in the language of the Mishnah itself, the most ancient text we have among these texts here, that we do have this concept that it was at that age of 13 that one becomes responsible for mitzvot in the majority in that sense. So the Mishnah goes on. By the way, what do you think of this idea about the rabbis speaking in a lashon naki, in a clean language?
In the Talmud, they use panim shel mata for that area of the body to explain. So it's the same face, the upper and lower. So I don't see why not. I want to make the Mishnah make a definition of three stages in life of a ben. Up to the 2 pubic hair, the period until it grows, and then as an adult. Correct? So there are three.
Good.
In a male, that's the three section or whatever period of life cycle.
So ultimately, by this Mishnah and by some other places in legal literature, with the sages, we do indeed see that the rabbis, instead of just having a time period where you're a minor, and then you're of majority, they're now going to categorize a certain amount of time in which you can fall into the category of Ben Sorer Moreh. What I wouldn't go so far as to say is that the rabbis are now creating a three-stage developmental chart for when children grow. We should call them here Katan, a small, or a minor, or then a Ben, and that's kind of in-between phase, adolescent phase, and then Ish, or one of the four languages we have for a person of full majority, which I'll just mention on the onset. We'll come back to this notion. But the Torah really has four languages of a person who is a full-grown, blown adult. We have Adam, the first human, hearkening back to that. We have Enosh. We say that humanity in Hebrew is B'nai Enosh. We have Ish, which is for the rabbis a little bit of, and there are little distinctions within here, and how they're related to us, and when they're used in different places, they're kind of emphasizing different things, like the notion of ish will be about a person's physical power and a person's physical growth, versus enosh, a person's humanity, as we use the term b'nei enosh within humanity. And then we have gever and gazra, and that's a person's entire personhood, body and spiritual existence. And there's questions of whether or not a person has responsibilities to do mitzvot, vis-a-vis whether it's a mitzvah gavra, it's a mitzvah that a person takes on, or it's a mitzvah shel a beged, in other words, like a talus. Is it the mitzvah for the beged, for the article of clothing that you tie the tzitzit to it, or is it the mitzvah of the person who, when they wear a four-cornered garment, has to tie the tzitzit onto it? That being said, for real terms that we use for people of majority, back up, ben sorer moreh is a category unique to this type of child whose behavior we will read about in a minute from Torah, and not necessarily that we're saying for all purposes that there are three categories of development within human reality. So
I want to continue. So in that case, if I'm an adult kid and I have parents, can I be sorer moreh?
If I'm an adult...
Yeah, and I don't treat my parents nice. I don't follow kabelet abicha ve'et imecha.
Oh, so again,
so
let's say that you're foreshadowing some of what the Gemara's project is. How far do we go with this category? Do you always remain in such a state once we know what this state is? Can I, if I have the power to sire children, become this category? And if I have parents... and then I start acting like this, do I fall back into that category? All good questions. But we'll wait for the Gemara. So to review. Ben sorer moreh. We have this category of ben sorer moreh. May matai na say ben sorer moreh. Well, from when can we say that a child can become stubborn and rebellious and fall into that category? From the time he has two hairs and they come in places where he didn't have them before, let's say, until the lower beard goes around. We're not talking about the beard of the face. So the Chachamim tell us, and the reason why it's put in that sense is because they want to use this beautiful language of cleanness and description. Shinemar. So we also in our studies know that every time we go to anchor ourselves in verses, we provide for ourselves the type of proof that people needed both in that ancient theater and in a world of deep-seated belief that God's will is revealed through the text. There have been conversations already this year about how anchoring ourselves within Torah verses, prophets verses, writings verses, is part of the project, is at the heart of the project of the Chachamim when it comes to proving to us that life should be understood this way, whether it's the Mishnaic direction or the Talmudic direction. That word, Shene Emar, is a key word. It's a key word to introduce you to the fact that I'm about to bring a verse and I'm about to do something with that verse. I'm either about to entirely prove it from that verse midrashically, a la a midrash agada or halacha, because there are two kinds of midrash. There's one that's a legal midrash and there's one that's a midrash that tells a tale, and from that kind of nomos, that narrative, we're going to learn out something important to our understanding of the law. And generally, we learn from verses of the Tanakh, and of course we give higher weight to verses of Torah than we do to, say, verses that come from other sections. But there are certain books that the rabbis like more than others. We often will learn things from Shir Shirim, for instance, from the Song of Songs, which is completely taken away from its pshat level, its simple sense, to say that all this sexuality is a metaphor for the relationship between God and Israel, and therefore from that I learn. And we saw that in the last chapter we learned here in the Beit Midrash. So here we have Shene Emar, Ki yihye le'ish ben. Taking a verse from the Torah, it says, if a man will have a son, ki yihye le'ish ben. It's stated in Deuteronomy chapter 21, verse 18, if a man will have a son, our translation, and the term son conveys two ideas. Ben v'lo bat. A son and not a daughter. It makes what's called in Talmudic parlance a miut. Mem yud ayin vav tet. We're going to delimit this. We're going to make this ma'at. We're going to bring this and exclude something based on the way the Torah phrases this. If it says, when a man, ki yihye le'ish, will have a ben, that means it's a ben and we're not talking about a bat. The Gemara wants to use this for other, this same limud, if you will, and the word limud is a learning out of a principle based on the way the Torah speaks. The Gemara uses this same limud in matters of boys and girls, sons and daughters, learning Torah, for instance. When it says, v'shinantam livanecha, in the Shema that we say, and you shall teach them diligently to your children, we often translate. But the Gemara goes and says, no, it says, v'shinantam livanecha. You will teach them diligently to your sons. V'lo livnotecha, and not to your daughters. But then there are lots of different arguments about whether or not we have an open door to actually teach both sons and daughters or not. And it begins the halachic debate. Here, vis-a-vis the category of ben sora amore, it delimits it only to sons, and there's never been a challenge. Why didn't we include daughters? Now, there's never been a challenge because there's not so many parents who would look at this and say, I really want to fit my daughter into that category. What's that category? Ben sorer amore. Let's look at that from the Torah now, since it mentioned the verse. So I gave you today as a handout. Could you take some, bring them back that way? There's some extras here for people who did not get. Everybody have?
Okay.
So I brought you the verses from the Torah because, and I wanted to do the verses from the Torah when the Mishnah mentioned them. Because the Mishnah is expecting us to be able to hypertext right into the world of the Torah. They imagined that their population knew Baal Peh in a kind of oral culture, the verses that were referred to beyond just the phrase that was mentioned when the Mishnaic teaching was recited. To remember that this is a performative tradition, this concept that Mishnayot were recited by the Tanaim and by their Mitargamim, by their translators. Someone in the Beit Midrash might have said, we know that this is about the Ben Sorer More, the son who's stubborn and rebellious, as it says, Shenemar, and then they point to the Mitargamon, that Tana's, that teacher's translator, and that teacher's translator stands up. And a translator is not just someone who translates the words, it's someone who memorizes the words and orally performs them. And that Mitargaman ultimately gives us over the verse from the Torah and or the requisite verses and repeats the Mishnah that's being taught. The verses come in chapter 21 of Deuteronomy. There are three verses that are within what's called Sagor, a closed part of the Torah, a little closed parsha, a little closed piece of legal work unto itself within the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is obviously one of the Chumashim that has a lot of law. And you see here the tradition, if you look at 18 and then you'll go till the beginning of that, to the beginning of that verse where it says, Ki Yihyeh, there's a samech, and kind of straight down with your finger, several lines, there's another samech. That's telling you that this is a closed part. This is a legal lesson unto itself, and I'm about to give you this law. yihyeh le'ish ben sorer u'moreh. If a man has a stubborn and rebellious child, ve'einenu shomea b'kol aviv u'v'kol imo, and he won't listen to the voice of his father or his mother, vayisuru oto, and though they chasten, or they kind of give him harsh words and they punish him, or vayisuru oto, velo yishma alehen, he still won't listen to them, even though it says in here this kind of words of reproach. But it's even understood to be the words of discipline, or try to turn him away, right? Because
Contain
or sur merav aseh tov, right? Turn from evil and do good, the psalm says.
Reproach and punishment. The words reproach, I think, and punishment is right.
Well, it could be that reproach and punish are definitely right by way of how we understand how a parent ultimately does discipline a child, especially in the world, in the ancient world. Or it could be that it really is the poetic notion that the psalm says, is sur me rav aseh tov, that you turn from it and you make this turning motion. There's also in our tradition the word musar, which is lessons that are supposedly turning you from the world of non-faith to faith, the world of good behavior each moment to the looking for the next opportunity to live out some of God's will.
Trials of Job.
And then there is this notion that sometimes we're turned into tragedy and sometimes turned into suffering. So the question is, what is the definition of this child? Ben sorer u'moreh. So I wanted to bring a tool that was mentioned once in class. A tool that maybe you've seen the inside of, maybe you haven't in class, but if you turn the page. This is the dictionary called the Hebrew and English Lexicon of the Old Testament. It's based on Justinius' work, and it's edited by three people, Brown, Driver, and Briggs. And in order to get it to a place of publishing in the English world, they needed to put in a lot of work. That's why there had to be three of them, I think. And like a Beit Din, they argued about which is the best one to put as definition number one, which is the best one to put as definition number two, which verses from the Tanakh should we put before the other ones, because we're not just going to go in order when it comes to defining words. We might bring something from the prophets before we bring something from Genesis. So I wanted to show you the translations of the two central words we're talking about, because at the end of the day, what we're talking about is a very unique category of child for which there's a great punishment. The punishment of stoning him to death. He's mara. Look on the first column here. He's contentious, refractory, and rebellious. So, it ultimately tells you right in definition number one, if you go down past the different versions of the verb that are used, and some of the references there. See number one? That's our reference. Ben sorer u'moreh. The first entry is Deuteronomy 21, verses 18 through 20. Stubborn and rebellious son. Now look what he does, though. This is an interesting piece to me. Towards who? Towards the father. For people who read the Bible like us, we know that's not what we just read. Right? We read, if he doesn't listen to what? The voice of his father and the voice of his mother. So sometimes, if you're looking for even the best tools we have for translation and for understanding these kinds of terms, we see that there's some type of delimiting that these scholars have done for whatever the reason. Now, they might understand that because of some notion that the father is the one in ancient law particularly Roman law, who can, more than just a short period of time, bring a rebellious son to the court and have him killed, and ask the court to kill him, whereas in Jewish legal parlance, we say there's only a certain period of time, based on these verses we're about to read the continuation of, that happens, but it's a very short window. And then we, by the way, you know, just to absolutely give it away, the question becomes, do we really ever do this? But we have here this verb being translated as rebellious. And then we have so rare. So look at the entry sarar on the right-hand side of the page. Sarar is to be stubborn, rebellious. So we have sorarim. Now what do we not have here? We don't have... What?
The issue is not the other word that we will discuss.
Exactly. Because that's not this root. That's samech vavresh. So the Torah is playing with this powerful notion of being rebellious, so rare, and the turning away being similar in terms of its sounding. You can either be this or that. Now, I believe what's going on with the language there in terms of so rare as being rebellious and lasur, sur mira va'ase tov, turn away from evil and do good. It's so close, right? It's so close. How close is it that someone can be in this place of being a good soul, of turning away, of being able to turn away, even if they're a little rebellious? How close are they to being so rare or being in this mode of sur, of turning away, versus the so rare? It's just linguistically comes together to say there's such a fine line between this category of one who's really trying to listen and do better by his parents and one who's truly rebelling and out there as a total contentious and rebellious son. So this lexicon is oftentimes the place to go if we're having a real kind of look into the translation of the Torah. Back to the Torah text on the front page. So he listens neither to his father or his mother, and though they discipline him, I want to say, he doesn't listen to them. Verse 19, Vitafsuvo aviv v'imo, and then his father and his mother lay hold of him, Vahotzioto el ziknea iro, and they bring him unto the elders of his city, ve'el sha'ar mekomo, and to the gate of the place. Right? Now why do they bring him to the elders at the gate? That's where the elders sit. The gate to a city is oftentimes not just a nice architectural gateway. And even like the gates of the old city don't exactly work like this. But if you go up to a place like Tel Dan, you'll see that the gate to the city, this little area, this little municipality they built, has benches around the side and even down the first wall. And the elders used to sit there, and that's where court happened, if they had any issues at all. So you could imagine, on certain times and days, they gathered there, and this father and mother, whose kid was so out of control, I have nothing else to do with this kid.
Would be nice if we had it today.
Yeah, I'm telling
you. We drag them there to the elders. We take them there. Va'amro ziknei ro, and they say to the elders of the city, Beninu ze, our son, sorer umore, is rebellious and stubborn. Einenu shomea bekolenu, he does not listen to our voice. Zolel v'sove, he's a glutton and a drunkard. He eats too much, he drinks too much. Urgamu kol anchei ro ba'avanim, and then the men of his city shall stone him with stones, v'meit, so that he die. Uviarta hara mikirbecha, and you shall send away the evil from within your midst. V'chol Yisrael yishmu v'yirau, and all Israel will hear and fear, will be struck in their hearts. So what do you make of that?
Yeshua just coming from our Bible?
Exactly, a trial.
There's kind of an internal contradiction here, because if a man have a stubborn and rebellious son, but the charge has to be brought according to the text by both the mother and the father, because the son is defined, a rebellious son is one who does not listen to the voice of his father or his mother. So why doesn't it say if a man and a woman have a son? And then the question of bringing them to the elders in the gates of the city, not exactly taking them to court, because he doesn't have the right to bring his own witnesses and defend himself. Only the parents. The parents are the only witness. So, having studied the first half of the year, the laws of trial in a capital case, this doesn't conform exactly. So, well, for me, it seems to be a number of issues in this.
So good, you're picking apart the text the way the Gemara ultimately is going to ask some questions about it as well. And oftentimes when we study verses from the Torah and we really put on our Talmud brains, we come up with the same questions that Talmudic masters do, and we want to see the same kinds of issues sometimes that they do. So A, does this come from our Bible? Hold that thought, because there's a certain philosophical bent within all of this literature that we're going to have to take very seriously in that sense. Is this legislation ultimately put for the purpose of actually carrying through with the actual legal outcome that the Torah prescribes? Or are we to learn God's will through some midrashic progression of our understanding of the verses themselves and the messages therein, which we know is at the very heart of our tradition, this notion?
So, on the face of it, there's no role for the parents, as I told. If the child is bad, what happens? What did the parents do? Why didn't they bring up the child to be good?
Oh.
And then the whole question of free will, though. Is a child of that age supposed to be thought to have free will, or parents who are supposed to mold the child?
Right, so it doesn't say the Zakenim ask him, her, the mother, the father, did you raise the child according to the way that we understand your responsibilities to be as a parent? Did you follow what it says in the Masechet Kedushin, or hey, have you listened to what it says over here? That you're required to teach your child Torah, that you're required to teach your child even a trade, how to swim, according to some authorities. There are Torah kind of things you're supposed to teach your child, and there's some good playing sports that you're supposed to teach your child, or at least that you're supposed to do, because half the world is water, or more than that, right? They didn't exactly have fractions down, but got to know how to survive should you fall into a pond, fall into the sea, the Yamagadol, the big sea, the ocean. Back to the points about the contradiction internally also. Is it only the father? Allah, we saw that maybe there's a tradition that informs even biblical scholars when they're writing their translating dictionaries of our chapter in Deuteronomy, where it says, maybe it is only the father. Maybe that's why the parenthesis, Justinius, Brown, Driver, Briggs, the internal workings of the lexicon that lets us translate our Torah and the Bible into English, many translators both in our tradition and outside of our tradition. The notion that the mother and the father, does it say that they exactly agree? So again, foreshadowing to what Gemara will come up with by way of investigation.
Well, there are of course many things, but a couple are, it just seems to me as though you would only do this if you had done everything that you thought you should do with the child. This is a rebellious child, regardless of what the parents did. this is a child that doesn't respond, I would think, because this is a rare indication. So I would think that what's kind of assumed is that the parents did everything that they tried to do, everything they were supposed to do, and this child was just completely recalcitrant. Another couple of things are throwing in the glutton and the drunkard. You know, it's kind of interesting. If they say that this child is rebellious and that doesn't listen and everything, but you have to, like, put that in to describe something even beyond that. It's certain qualities that I guess we think indicates that this is whatever character that is just kind of beyond. So, it doesn't seem to me as though it's necessary to do it, but it's interesting that they throw that in. And the last is that, obviously the important thing is that all Israel shall hear and fear. So you kind of feel as though this is supposed to be a cautionary tale. This is supposed to be so that everybody will, that the children will hear, all Israel, the other children will be afraid, and maybe it's really there to be heard and to make everybody afraid.
Right, so that unique phrase...
Right.
But the gluttony and the drunkenness, to me, is indispensable. Because what it indicates to me is this is a child out of control. Mm-hmm. And the child might not be out of control by the child, by pure will or whim, but the child might be out of control because of emotional illness, mental illness, and that they don't know how to express, except to say, okay, they're not responding to the parent. But all of us watch people who are off kilter, and if they do drugs or they drink too much or ruin their bodies, we realize then perhaps there's something more. And I think that's why it fills out the picture to me. I have great empathy for this young man, because I feel that this young man today would be, of course, given a tremendous amount of Ritalin from a very young age. Right. And he would be sent to...
Four Winds Hospital.
Right, three steps. Yes, thank you. Sorry, I was going to say, right. Or
that's where he's going.
Right, thank you.
Keep it in the family.
Right. But I do think you're supposed to read that. And I think you're supposed to have both sides of the story of how challenging it is and almost overwhelming for the family. But at the same time, there is this child who perhaps is a child in tremendous pain.
Right, so there are pieces here about the recognition of mental health, about overeating, and the kind of step approach we had to Overeaters Anonymous today, already noticed here in the ancient world with gluttony, drinking, the understanding that alcoholism is a reality by way of Torah, that end phrase definitely being a phrase that others have said as well, Bobby, that it's here to be a cautionary tale, it's true. The kind of benefit of the doubt that you started with in terms of, well, they did everything they possibly could. It's lovely. We know some parents don't and can't, whichever way that goes.
Well, that's
and
easy.
It's,
I think it's harder to say some people do and it doesn't work.
And then I was going to say, on top of that, there are people who are at wit's end. And they're to the point where, without the kind of community support that's necessary and could be called upon, and or the latest and greatest, and or something tried and true, they never get out of this mess with their feeling inadequate. And it's not only about the mental anguish of the individual child; it's the inadequacy and the feelings of what more can I do except bring them to the Zikneh Ha'ir. And if they throw up their hands, What good would that do? So it may be a punch towards finding solutions in this thing. The reality stands is that using the examples, though, of gluttony and achila, of eating, and shtia, of drinking, might be a unique glance at the kind of things that the entire system of our mitzvot are trying to teach us. Before I get to the next comments, the Ramban, in a very famous dose of Parshanut, commentary on Parshat Kedoshim, on Holy You Should Be, goes and explains to you there are two ways you can be in life, to put it on a spectrum for a moment. there's either you could be bifnim mishurat hadin, you can be someone who goes above and beyond even the letters of the law to both exercise menschlichkeit, goodness, and someone who exercises a certain kind of humaneness and approach to doing mitzvot that benefit you and others, and you're always asking what's needed here. That's lifnim mishurat hadin. Or, the Ramban says, you can be naval bereshut haTorah. You can be a glutton even when the Torah permits you to do something. So that's kosher food. Go ahead. Except you eat in a gluttonous way. That's the peshat of it. Or the Torah says that you can lay tefillin, and this is exactly how you do tefillin, and every morning you put on your tefillin. But then you go, and you wind up stealing from everybody in the company who trusts you as a partner. That's being naval bereshut haTorah. So the examples that they use could be, in essence, metaphorical even, for the entire nature of how one is supposed to be becoming. Someone who deals with the yetzer hara, the inclination to do evil, and how one puts it down.
We're in the footnote here, number one, it mentions thievery.
Right.
Where do they get that?
Okay, so that's going to be an interesting piece of Gemara. They bring it in as an example of what this child does. And you see that here in the Torah it said glutton and a drunkard. It didn't mention thievery.
Right.
But there'll be a question as to what constitutes these actions that are stubborn and rebellious actions, and they'll take it far beyond simply eating and drinking as well.
The problem is there's three terms. Does not hearken to our voice, gluttony, and drunkard. To me, that describes awful lot. And you would be marching an awful lot of people right to the gate. Mm-hmm. And having him stoned. There has to be some further definition. I mean,
okay, so we're going to get to those definitions.
My whole life in graduate school.
Right. We're going to get to those definitions. That's part of what the Gemara's project is here.
I'm struck by a number of things. First, the person has to have a father. If he has a mother but not a father, it doesn't qualify. So a single mom can't do this, because that's the way we start. The second is that he has to have both features of being rebellious and stubborn.
Mm-hmm.
So that means it's okay to be stubborn,
mm-hmm.
and it means it's okay to be rebellious.
Mm-hmm.
It's only the combination that puts you in this category. And I think that actually fits well with child psychology, because there are some stubborn kids who aren't terribly rebellious, but they're stubborn. And there are some rebellious kids who might listen to you and therefore not be stubborn. So I think that I think that's interesting. The one thing that this brings to mind, though, is the issue of excommunication or banishment.
Mm-hmm.
Because it would seem to me that of all of the things that you might want in your quiver as tools to use, short of stoning, it might be that you would say, this is somebody who, like we do in our society, this is somebody who is beyond the pale, has transgressed the rules of the society,
mm-hmm.
And therefore shouldn't be allowed to participate, but not necessarily to kill them, because you can't come back from that if, in fact, they change their ways the next week. And
mm-hmm.
we also have Yom Kippur, so we have a tradition of having people have an opportunity to turn. So I think that I'm just interested in whether or not the concept of excommunication or banishment existed at all in this period.
Mm-hmm. Well, we definitely know that karet and excommunication is one of the legal means available to to Bate Din, and that it was sometimes carried out. The full-fledged notion here that you could learn from a place where it said, this is how you shall deal with the problem, stone him to death, and instead of that, you shall do this instead, whatever the kind of punishment, I'm not sure that they had the mechanism in place to understand that that might be the normative or actual place to go.
Well, I mean, to me, the overriding thing is the rabbis of the Talmudic period know this is the Torah, know this is the law.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also pretty clear that they weren't eager to have this occur commonly for reasons that I think reflect their value system at that time, and now how to and that's what I think is so fascinating, is how do you reconcile those two things, and how do you wind up with a very, very narrow, ultimately with a very narrow definition without doing damage to the Torah's intent.
Right, right. For them, I don't think there was any damage. In essence, rereading and finding from their either philosophical underpinnings or from their conception of reality, or from their thinking about it even back in ancient terms, that it was very severely limited, and that these came as precautionary tales. But this is going to inform us. They're interested in categorical definitions here further in the Mishnah to say to us, let's look at really how this goes in order to potentially so know that this is a time period to watch this child and to add extra amounts of what the verse implies, which is turning him, disciplining him, teaching him, that potentially is the message that underpins it all as well. So the system that you've got to include here is a system of learning mitzvot and responding to the burgeoning yetzer hara, the inclination to do evil, that comes along with manna. Now, I want to go back to the Mishnah, so we can go further. It says, "Ki yel le'ish ben," when a man has a son. Okay, for two things we can learn. First of all, we learn ben velo bat. A son can be declared a ben tore, but not a daughter. And it also says ben velo ish. A son, i.e., that is, says here, a youth, can be declared a ben sorer more, but not a more fully developed man whose pubic hair has grown around. In other words, around the organs, reproductive organs. Now, that is going to get us into a question of, again, what does this word ben really mean in this sense? Is it when he's at the end stage of not being of majority age? Or is it at the beginning stage of his actual ishhood, his manhood, and now we're going to define a certain period where he could be ben sorer more? It definitely seems that we're that direction. Because from the time you have two pubic hairs, the assumption is, as the translation suggested, which wasn't really here in the Mishnah that said 13 davka, but the age 13 was basically established as the time that two pubic hairs came in. And that's basically when anybody looked for them, if there was any real question. And they used the basic counting of years. And we know we did count, and we were interested in that time from which a child was born, to count them as an age of majority. And so we have the distinction, it's ben velo bat, it's a son but not a daughter, and ben velo ish, whatever that's going to really mean. A ben and not a man. A son or a youth and not a man. Now, if we have the fact that it's going to then be singled out as a ben, and it's not just meaning a son, not a daughter, but it is going to be a category of male youth, why did I need you to tell me that that youth would be responsible for the mitzvot for which he is now obligated, and call him a ben, if already he left the age of being a katan? Because normally the Gemara says, or the Mishnah says here, the term ben you would have thought meant child. By telling me that ben and lo ish, but telling me that it is this category of being just before your total man, I'm now confused. In other words, the term ben which I thought was a child, would not have obligated him to those mitzvot. But you're telling me you can now use that term, Ben, to obligate him for the mitzvot. So what term do I use for a child that's younger?
Katan.
Katan. And the Mishnah says, here we go, Katan Hatur. A young child, a katan, a small child, is exempt from being punished, what? As a ben sorera more. In this case, they're interested in telling you that katan is patur, because I don't need to tell you a katan is really patur from other mitzvot. Because when a child becomes bar mitzvah, has two pubic hairs, and then becomes an ish, whether or not I classify the beginning of that as a ben or not, I know that he's obligated. What I'm really talking about is when he's obligated or not in terms of being a ben sorer or more. And I'm going to tell you at the end of the Mishnah that even though I said it's a ben and not a man, I'm not talking about him being a katan. I'm going to use another term for when he's not exempt, when he's not required to do any mitzvot. That is the word katan. Katan is patur. Shelo ba lichlal mitzvot. That he has not entered the realm of the commandments. He hasn't come into the obligations of doing the commandments. And therefore the laws of Ben Sorer Umare are inapplicable. The Mishnah now has categorically told us that, first of all, you might have thought Ben Sorer Umare means that it's a child who is rebellious and contentious and stubborn, and because it says Ben, you might have thought that that meant before he actually became a person of majority. Not the case. What I'm telling you is that there's a Ben category that's definitely not fully Ish, but it is when he is of majority age, and I use the term katan to say that's the period which he's not obligated, and therefore during that period of being a katan, he can't be called a ben sorer more. Okay? So now I've got my category set up. Gemara. That's what we're going to see, because they're delimiting. Okay, so it says katan minalan de patur in the Gemara. The Gimel Mem is obviously the beginning of the Gemara section of our Talmud. Katan minalan de patur, a minor. From where do we know that a minor is patur, is exempt? Now, if I didn't contextualize this in the discussion of Ben Sorer More, that question wouldn't make sense. Because if already I'm saying it's a katan, I know a katan is patur from mitzvot, is exempt from mitzvot. But what I want to really talk about is this category again of ben sorer more. I want to know whether or not this youth who is before bar mitzvah and is obligated for mitzvot can fit into this category. So where do we know that a katan is exempt from this category of ben sorer more? The Gemara then is going to come and say, Minavan, from where do we know this? Bidikatane tama, because the Mishnah has taught us the reason. Shelo ba lichlal mitzvot, because he's not actually come into the time where he's got full obligations for the mitzvot. And if he has no obligations for the mitzvot,
he's a katan.
He's a katan, and therefore can't be a ben sorer amare. Vatu, and more. Heicha ashkechan de anash hakatuv. Where have you ever found scripture punishing a minor for violating a commandment? That you should require a verse to exempt him from punishment as a ben sorer more. So in other words, why do you need to bring me a limud, a lesson, a verse that's going to prove that he can't be brought up as a ben sorer more, if I know simply from the reality of law and legislation that we've created that he would be exempt anyway? What does that mean? That it might mean when you read this, you think that he, as a stubborn and rebellious kid, it isn't one mitzvah or another, but maybe it's such to the point that you think that it's possible you could bring him to the Zikne Ha'ir, to the elders of the city, and say, this child fits into this category. Obligated for the mitzvot or not? And the Gemara is going to now respond. Anan hachi ka'amarinan, this is what we meant to say, atu ben sorer more al chet o neherag. But is a ben sorer more executed for a sin of his that's already committed? Certainly not. Here's the famous word about this. Why is he actually put to death? Al shem sofo neherag. It's for his end, the eventual outcome of his current behavior, that he's actually put to death. Because he may become a murderer, according to the parentheses, or may become someone who is so evil among your people that you need to remove it. And this is
preemptive punishment.
Preemptive punishment. Preemptive punishment.
They used drones.
No, this is more like what's come from Newton on a Newtown on dealing with people with mental illness.
We do hear it among people who really believe that there should be action taken.
You have the Rashi here. He says, let him die innocent and let him not die guilty. So
we're going to go back to the Rashi. That's good, because we're going to go back to the Rashi. Rashi is going to be taking, and what I want to show, and we'll keep these in our Gemaras or around on the shelf, Rashi, with whom we often read the Chumash, is going to be borrowing from pieces of our Talmud and pieces of another Midrash that exists on this passage of Torah, and Rashi's going to be putting together the puzzle of what the Chumash, what the Torah is really saying, based on the fact that he's got these books on a shelf. It's wonderful to see when Rashi is using the very sources that we're learning. So as part of what we're going to look at a little down the line. And I just want to finish this small section in terms of the thought before we say one more word about it. V'chevan da'al shem sofo nerag, and since on account of the fact that his eventual behavior is the reason why we put him to death at this point, afilu katanami, you might think that if I identify this child as being stubborn and rebellious as a katan, as a child who's not yet responsible for the mitzvot, and he's not of majority age, I could put him to death now. Because I've identified it. We've identified it. Father and mother. So ultimately, that's the reason why the Mishnah has to come and inform us that a katan is patur, meaning a katan cannot be held accountable to this category of slirut, this rebelliousness and this kind of contentiousness. It's in essence saying, legally, you know, did you ever do this about one other thing in Judaism? Well, if you tell me that I should have my Shabbos candles lit in one place where I'm going to eat, maybe I can still put them over here, because later on I'm going to have a snack. You know, but normatively, Jews have this kind of legal outlook on life, and they make all kinds of distinctions, and they ask questions. This is one where you might have thought that. Now, it seems philosophically, humanistically, not so logical or within the framework of our legal reasoning to further and expand upon the category of people who might fit into this. Yet the Gemara proposes that you just might expand this category. Because there's a piece of our legalism, our nature, that brings us to sometimes justify in legal terms that which we find acceptable, even sometimes at the expense of the kind of humanism, the philosophically merciful way of looking at the law.
I guess there's also a logic then why you don't need witnesses, because there's been no crime yet. So
that does answer a piece of that.
But I must say, knowing the history of the American eugenics movement, this is a chilling parallel to that notion of the intrinsic bad seed. It's painful to read.
It is painful. We will have to deal over many mesechtot with the pain of consideration of certain outlooks that we would have such kinds of punishments for X and Y and Z categories of people. This entire chapter, Ben Sora More, is an expansion on the question of, can one of our children be so rebellious and contentious that we would actually do this? Whereas there are not entire chapters written for the lists of people who fall into the category of those people who shall be stoned, as they are enumerated in chapter 7 of Masechet Sanhedrin. Actually, this harkens back to chapter 7, Mishnah 4, which at another point we'll look at, to say that there's a whole list of people. Here, though, at least we're going through the actual questions to say, do we really mean this?
Didn't we study with Rabbi Wexler about a month ago, or a month or two ago, that there is no death penalty?
The real death penalty is they have been executed. The penalty is there, but not the execution.
Right, so a piece of the legal work here is to distinguish ourselves as people who still learn the lesson, who do it as precautionary tales, not preemptory punishment perhaps, but in some form of warnings to people as to what a court may be able to do, either once in 70, once in 700. Rabbi Wexler referred to that famous midrash of Rabbi Kiva's, that the court would have only one capital punishment meted out in either 70 or 700 or in forever, and then the response, right?
That's a hanging court.
Well, then that will be a proliferation of murderers in Israel, according to another midrash. So the notion that we have capital punishment and an argument about it back from that time and whether or not it actually was carried out.
Well, one wonders what happened before all of these chacham began to talk about the Torah. I mean, the Torah existed for years, obviously, before the Talmud came into being. What did the people do then? All they had was the text.
Right, and there are various theories about what criminal jurisprudence looked like vis-a-vis the ancient Israelites and just what was meted out and what wasn't and what was there for warning. And
I don't know. I'm listening to this, and I think there's a little bit of a danger in taking for granted what the Torah, that what we're reading here is the Torah. It's like Rabbi Wexler's funny comment about his teacher who told the student, we don't believe in the Torah, we don't follow the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have to realize that this is amazingly creative and very important, because there are religions, we read about this every day, where they have texts that are similar to this, very brutal, very violent, horrible laws, and they implement them. They cut off your hands, they do terrible things, and people write about if only this other religion might have done what, let's say, our religious leader did in trying to bring the text from an ancient world, which probably was implemented many times, into a world that's very different. So even this text from the Mishnah, don't forget the Mishnah is also rabbis, and it's the Mishnaic rabbis who said, well, you might think that a katan should be punished for this. We say no. Well, that's not what the Torah says. We don't, the Torah is very explicit. If you read it and you say, if you have a child who misbehaves, you try a little bit with them, and then you go and you kill them.
It's true that the rabbis are the ones categorizing, and it's true that they're reacting to ancient law in those theaters, and we're not necessarily saying that, per se, Torah being overturned or upended or used in a hermeneutically relevant way, a la the Midrash or a la the kind of lessons that come out of verses in the fact that we have a Shneh Emar statement, as it says in the verse, to prove the point of the rabbinic understanding, and therefore it's really, quote-unquote, either yes, it is Torah or not, they're using the Torah in a system, a hermeneutical system, that I remember when I was listening to the story too, I was thinking about one of my teachers, Professor Bregman, who always used to quote Professor Yitzhak Heinemann, who was a great Hebrew University thinker about this legal move and reading verses to prove points and whether or not the Torah then seems so full of motion and rearrangement that we have the same Torah or not. So he would describe it as this kind of greatest trust in textual revelation, that we had something else to discover within the very sources that might have been different when a different court, chapter 15 in this very book of Deuteronomy, where we are six chapters later, said, don't move right or left from them and listen to the judge in that day, meaning they will judge how the verses work at that time. And for Professor Heinemann, it was that these midrashic moves and rearranging pesukim verses were the holiest word games that we can't comprehend. Because what they were doing is literally revealing the message that they felt God put into the world for a legal system that harkened back to that very moment for them of Sinai.
Right. The only thing I wanted to... point that I'm making is that I agree with Bobby that there's a, you know, there's a cautionary tale here.
But right.
It's far from self-evident that that's the way we would have ended up thinking in the year 2013. It is the way we think because of this and because of what we're reading here, not because of what we're reading.
Agreed.
You could be in a totally different
agreed.
World.
And the way the rabbis are reacting to ancient law, listen to the scholarship about it. The Hebrew parent did not possess the power of life and death over his child. In Greece, weak children were exposed, this was their category of law, left on a lonely mountain to perish. And in Rome, a father could at will put even a grown-up son to death. In Israel, when vice and insubordination in an adolescent son had become intolerable, the parents must appeal to the decision of an impartial tribunal. The death penalty could only be inflicted by the community and the sanction of the elders of the city. So it's not evident that great legal systems were going to be created. And Torah, from the time of Yitro, suggesting a court system, and Shoftim and Shotrim, were at the heart of our project, and so too into the reality here. The reality here unfolds, though, that they want to still give you the Hava Amina. This might be the, I'm going to put the possibility out that you might think this way, and the attachment to the human project of a law that doesn't look like this is written within the system here to recognize that we have some of those inclinations even perhaps within ourselves.
It's interesting what you just said, because what occurred to me is that by including the mother, after all, the father's the one that brings them, but they include that the mother agrees with this and that the mother also has assessed that. And my experience is that mother and father don't always agree exactly on how much to, you know, how lenient to be and how terrible the kid is. And usually one of them between the two is more lenient and would not take the child. So if you make this, that they both have to agree, because maybe the mother is the one that says, oh, he's a really good boy, and, you know, he's sweet with me, and whatever, it goes on between them.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they are both agreeing is another limitation and also
right.
End of the road.
Right. The Gemara is going to get into that.
They're giving you the bookend to the Akedah, where Abraham takes Isaac by himself, and Sarah is left out. And so, to me, the profound part of this is that the mother and father, I mean, I'll call it the evolution in the Bible, not to offend anyone, but the evolution that both parties have to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what you're supposed to be reminded of here, because you also have the contrast to whoever said it first, the father has the son. But then the father and the mother have to act in unison. So we move, we're reminded, but then we moved to the inclusionary factor.
Yeah, Jay.
to me, there's a level in Sobey aspect. It may not mean this at all, but to me, that means there's a communal aspect to what's happening, that this is public. This is a person who is just recognized as being problematic, and that's it's not necessarily the reason we don't hear about a trial taking place, but it's already established that this person is way outside the bounds. But I like that it brings a communal aspect to what's happening, because we think of our families as being so private and distinct from one another.
Mm.
But we forget that here it's, you know, it takes a village to have that.
You know, let me just push through the last piece of the Gemara here. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. So Rav Yehuda says in the name of Rav. De Amar Kra, as it says in the verse, V'ki Yehiyeh Le'ish Ben. As the scripture states, or as Torah states, if there will be to a man a wayward and rebellious son, which could mean, and if a wayward and rebellious son becomes a man, ben hasamuch legevurato shel ish. This teaches that the laws of ben sorer amore apply to a son who has nearly attained the strength of a man, i.e., that is to say, to the boy who sins soon after becoming an adult. Now, again, I want to come back to the notion here that we're concerned about the technicality of when it is that this category actually is tofes, actually applies. Could you interpret that verse to say that it actually is talking about the period of time that a person has this? Well, Rav Yehuda says in the name of Rav that it's a ben samos l'gvurato shalish. This teaches that the laws of ben sorer amore only apply to his son who's nearly attained the strength of a man. So this kind of notion of having the strength of a man has to be considered in terms of what that means as well. And so what they're trying to, in some which way, shape, or form, conceive of is understanding the development of a child. The human development that goes along with this kind of reality that we face. And if I limit the time, I give a certain amount of credence to the fact that, well, during this time specifically, maybe I can come up with a response, a la what parents really need to do in order not to get there. And I again want to point out that I think that there's a certain level of prescriptive law with the use of the terms of children that we have here, which parallel the many halachic realities that we have for what one is obligated to do vis-a-vis what? Kitanim, which we have as language that we've heard from the Mishnah, banim, a ben, and which is why again it's being looked at so pointedly vis-a-vis this verse, because it's vishinantam levanecha, you should teach them diligently to your children, specifically in this case ben velo bat, your son and not your daughter, and the notion of what an ish really is and how to look at being a man in this way of having the physical power to become a father of children will be the notion here in Samuch legevurato. Samuch legevurato is the notion that he's close to his power to himself become a father. Close to his power to know that when he's a father, he might run into the same thing. And that's a piece here where, so that's why we're delimiting. Yeah?
We are talking about three categories of faith. Sorer, more, and toward the end, ara.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question that I want to raise here, ubi'arta ara mikirbecha.
Mm-hmm. Exile the evil from within your midst.
Open end description of everything that is not good.
Right.
So basically, we can kill everyone that we decided, or the people who sit in the corners, decided that it's not good, which mm-hmm. is more, to me, it's weird. It's even worse than the Ben Sorer Umore. Because the summary of the whole chapter וביארת הרע מקרבך וכל ישראל ישמעו ויראו. So הרע is more difficult to me to understand than סורר ומורה, because סורר ומורה is very specific, while הרע is open and being said.
True.
And so it's much more problematic than
mm-hmm. And you could probably, in the hypertextuality that exists, he's saying the word evil is even more problematic, and what do we really think about this concept that a child could be evil, I imagine, is the question beneath the question. So you have in Torah the notion that Hayeled Ra min Ne'urav, a child is Ra from his youth, right? But then you have the ability to be Shomet Al Hayetzer, to control one's intentions, and if you can't then control the intentions, technically you're considered ra. So it could be that it's a technical legal term as much as it is the kind of evil that we're thinking of in the broader.
Or an open end, not goodness.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't need to be evil.
I want to go back to one limud that the Gemara brings next. Vad she yakif zakana tachtonam, on the bottom of the first column on page 68, B2. So, until the lower beard grows. So, if we're talking about the first part being the two hairs, what's the end, according to the Gemara, the time when the lower beard grows, the pubic hair? Tanu Rabbi Chia teaches, Ad Shiyakif Atara, until the hair grows around the pubic area like a crown. Now, not everybody's going to have it like this physically. But in his experience, this is how pubic hair grows on children and boys. And this is the kind of measure I'm going to use. Ki atar Rav Dimi Amar, when Rav Dimi arrived in Babylonia, he said, Hakafat gid velo hakafat beitzim, when it goes around the male member and not around the testicles. So they're interested in this fact, trying to again put a specific limit on when this can happen, when this is, that a person has responsibility for his actions. And at that point, when you have responsibility for your actions, despite the fact that you have problems with behavior, you had best control yourself, or else you're going to be brought to the Zakanim, to the gate, to the judges, and you could potentially be stoned to death. So the notion here in Rav Chista's reality is, Rav Chia's reality is that I'm going to help define this further with some of the physical traits, and then we're even going to go on. And earlier, when Rav expounds the verse to be teaching that a minor can't become a ben sorer amore, the Gemara wants to take the whole notion again of this katan, goes back to a discussion that they had about Amar Rav Chista. Rav Chista says, katan shaholid, if a minor fathered a son, aim beno naase ben sorer amore, his son cannot become a ben sorer amore. Shenemar, ki yihyeh le'ish ben. You're telling me that it's only about when an ish, a person of majority, has a child. Therefore, when a katan, who can actually be molid, a katan who actually sires a father, can't have a ben sorer amore. Le'ish ben, velo leven ben. For a person of majority, he may have that son that fits into this category, but a person who's a minor can't. What's the question, developmentally? Can a minor really have a baby? And we'll hear some scientific thinking of the rabbis next time.
The focus on the sexual makes me believe that maybe it's not just as a timing point. That maybe hidden in here is a fear of the sex abusing being raped, or that the focus is really because now the style is a sexual purity in which their sexuality may be used in this rebellious or stubborn way. Yeah.